Canterbury. Never mind. Liesel wants you. I looked at Liesel, who was smiling as charmingly as her dreadfully enlarged jaw would permit, and said, "She cannot possibly know anything about me." "You underestimate yourself, Ramsay," she said. "Are you not the writer of 100 Saints for Travellers, and Forgotten Saints of the Tyrol, and Celtic Saints of Britain and Europe? When Isengrim mentioned last night that he had seen you in the audience, and that you had insisted on lending your handkerchief, I wanted to meet you at once. I am obliged to you for much information, but far more for many happy hours reading your delightful prose. A distinguished hagiographer does not often come our way." There is more than one kind of magic. This speech had the effect of revealing to me that Liesel was not nearly so ugly as I had thought, and was indeed a woman of captivating intellect and charm, cruelly imprisoned in a deformed body. I know flattery when I hear it, but I do not often hear it. Furthermore, there is good flattery and bad. This was from the best cask. And what sort of woman was this, who knew so odd a word as hagiographer in a language not her own? Nobody who was not a Bollandist had ever called me that before, yet it was a title I would not have exchanged to be called Lord of the Isles. Delightful prose! I must know more of this. Many people, when they are flattered, seek immediately to show themselves very hard-headed, to conceal the fact that they have taken the bait. I am one of them. "Your plan sounds woefully uneconomic to me," I said. "Traveling shows in our time are money losers, unless they play to capacity audiences and have strong backing. You are planning an entertainment of rare quality. What makes you think it can survive? Certainly I have no advice to give you that can be of help there."
"That is not what we ask of you," said Liesel. "We shall look for advice about finance from financiers. From you we want the benefit of your taste, and a particular kind of unusual assistance, for which, of course, we expect to pay."
In other words, no amateurish interference or inquisitiveness about the money. But what could this unusual assistance be?
"Every magician has an autobiography, which is sold in the theatre and elsewhere," she continued. "Most of them are dreadful things, and all of them are the work of another hand. Do you say ghost-written? We want one that will be congruous with the entertainment we offer. It must be very good, yet popular, persuasive, and written with style. And that is where you come in, dear Ramsay."
With an air that in another woman would have been flatteringly coquettish, she laid a huge hand over one of mine and engulfed it. "If you want me to write it over my own name, it is out of the question."
"Not at all. It is important that it appear to be an autobiography. We ask you to be the ghost. And in case such a proposal is insulting to such a very good writer, we offer a substantial fee. $3,500 is not bad. I have made inquiries."
"Not good, either. Give me that and a half share in the royalties, and I might consider it." "That's the old grasping Ramsay blood," said Isengrim, and laughed the first real laugh I had heard from him. "Well, consider what you ask. The book would have to be fiction. I presume you don't think the world will swallow a courtier of polished manner if he is shown to be the son of a Baptist parson in rural Canada."
"You never told me your father was a parson," said Liesel. "What a lot we have in common. Several of my father's family are parsons."
"The autobiography, like the personality, will have to be handmade," said I. "And as you have been telling me all through lunch, distinguished works of imagination are not simply thrown together."
"But you will not be hard on us," said Liesel. "You see, not any writer will do. But you, who have written so persuasively about the saints, slipping under the guard of the skeptic with a candor that is brilliantly disingenuous, treating marvels with the seriousness of fact, you are just the man for us.
We can pay, and we will pay, though we cannot pay a foolish price.
But I think that you are too much an old friend of magic to say no."
In spite of her marred face, her smile was so winning that I could not say no. This looked like an adventure, and at 50, adventures do not come every day. 4. At 50, should adventures come at all? Certainly that was what I was asking myself a month later. I was heartily sick of Magnus Isengrim and his troop, and I hated Lieselotte Vitzliputzli, which was the absurd name of his monstrous business partner. But I could not break the grip that their vitality, their single-mindedness, and the beautiful mystery of their work had fastened on my loneliness. For the first few days it was flattering to my spirit to sit in the stalls in the empty theater with Liesel while Isengrim rehearsed. Not a day passed that he did not go through a searching examination of several of his illusions, touching up one moment or subduing another, and always refining that subtle technique of misdirecting the attention of his audience, which is the beginning and end of the conjurer's art. To me, it was deeply satisfying to watch him, for he was a master of all those sleights that had seemed so splendid and so impossible in my boyhood. Secure and palm 6 half-crowns, he could do it with either hand. His professional dress coat almost brought tears to my eyes, such a marvel was it of loading pockets, pochette, and profonde. When it was filled and ready for his appearance in the Dream of Midas, it weighed 12 pounds, but it fitted him without a bulge. My opinion was sought and given about the program. It was on my advice that the second part of his entertainment was reshaped. I suggested that he cut out the escape act entirely. It was not suitable to an illusionist, for it was essentially a physical trick and not a feat of magic. There was no romance about being stuck in a milk can and getting out again. This gave Liesel a chance to press for the inclusion of the brazen head of Friar Bacon, and I supported her strongly. It was right for the character of the show they were building. But Isengrim the Great had never heard of Friar Bacon, and like so many people who have not heard of something, he could not believe that anybody but a few eccentrics would have done so. "It is unmistakably your thing," I said. "You can tell them about the great priest-magician and his brazen head that foretold the future and knew the past. I'll write the speech for you. It doesn't matter whether people have heard of Bacon or not. Many of them haven't heard of Dr. Faustus, but they like your conclusion." "Oh, every educated person has heard of Faust," said Isengrim with something like pomposity. "He's in a very famous opera." He had no notion that Faust was also in one of the world's greatest plays. He had virtually no education, though he could speak several languages, and one of the things Liesel had to teach him, as tactfully as possible, was not to talk out of his depth. I thought that much of his extraordinarily impressive personality arose from his ignorance, or rather from his lack of a head full of shallow information that would have enabled him to hold his own in a commonplace way among commonplace people. As a schoolmaster of 20 years' experience, I had no use for smatterers. What he knew as well as anybody on earth. It gave him confidence, and sometimes a naive egotism that was hard to believe. We worked very hard on the brazen head, which was no more than a very good thought-reading act dressed in a new guise. The brazen head was levitated by Isengrim and floated in the middle of the stage, apparently without wires or supports. Then the girls moved through the audience, collecting objects that were sealed in envelopes by their lenders. Isengrim received these envelopes on a tray on the stage and asked the head to describe the objects and identify their owners. The head did so, giving the row and seat number for each. Only then did Isengrim touch them. Next, the head gave messages to 3 members of the audience, chosen apparently at random, relating to their personal affairs. It was a first-rate illusion, and I think the script I wrote for it, which was plain and literate, and free of any of the pompous rhetoric so dear to conjurers, had a substantial part in creating its air of mystery. Rehearsal was difficult because much depended on the girls who collected the objects. They had to use their heads, and their heads were not the best developed part of them. The random messages were simple but dangerous, for they relied on the work of the company manager, a pickpocket of rare gifts. But he had an air of transparent honesty and geniality, and as he mingled with the audience when it entered the theater, shaking hands and pressing through the crowd as if on his way somewhere else to do something very important, nobody suspected him. Sometimes he found invaluable letters in the coats of distinguished visitors when he took these to his office to spare such grandees the nuisance of lining up at the garderobe. but in the case of ladies or men of no special importance, it was straight dipping and potentially dangerous. He enjoyed it. It put him in mind of the good old days before he got into trouble and left London for Rio. Because of a message the Brazen Head gave a beautiful lady in the very first audience before which it was shown, a duel was fought the next day between a well-known Mexican lawyer and a dentist who fancied himself as a Don Juan. Nothing could have been better publicity, and all sorts of people offered large sums to be permitted to consult the Brazen Head privately. Isengrim, who had a perfectionist's capacity for worry, was fearful that such revelations would keep people out of the theater. But Liesel was confident and exultant. She said they would come to hear what was said about other people, and they did. Liesel's job was to speak for the Brazen Head, because she was the only member of the company capable of rapidly interpreting a letter or an engagement book and composing a message that was spicy without being positively libelous. She was a woman of formidable intelligence and intuition. She had a turn for improvising and phrasing ambiguous but startling messages that would have done credit to the Oracle at Delphi. The Brazen Head was such a success that there was some thought of putting it at the end of the show, as the topper, but I opposed this. The foundation of the show was romance, and the vision of Dr. Faustus had it. But the Head was our best effort in sheer mystery. I cannot refrain from boasting that it was I who provided the idea for one of the illusions that made Isengrim the most celebrated magician in the world. Variety theaters everywhere abounded with magicians who could saw a woman in two. It was my suggestion that Isengrim should offer to saw a member of the audience in two. His skill as a hypnotist made it possible. When we had worked out the details and put the illusion on the stage, he would first perform the commonplace illusion, sawing one of his showgirls into two sections with a circular saw and displaying her with her head smiling from one end of a box while her feet kicked from the other, but with a hiatus of 3 feet between the two parts of the box. Then he would offer to do the same thing with a volunteer from the audience. The volunteer would be lightly anesthetized by hypnosis, ostensibly so that he would not wriggle and perhaps injure himself, after which he would be put in a new box, and Isengrim would saw him in two with a large and fearsome lumberman's saw. The volunteer was shown to be divided, but able to kick his feet and answer questions about the delightfully airy feeling in his middle. Rejoined, the volunteer would leave the stage decidedly dazed, but marveling at himself and pleased with the applause. The high point of this illusion was when two assistants held a large mirror so that the volunteer could see for himself that he had been sawn in two. We substituted this illusion for the rather ordinary hypnotic stuff that had been in the show when first I saw it. Working on these illusions was delightful, but destructive of my character. I was aware that I was recapturing the best of my childhood. My imagination had never known such glorious freedom, but as well as liberty and wonder, I was regaining the untruthfulness, the lack of scruple, and the absorbing egotism of a child. I heard myself talking boastfully, lying shamelessly. I blushed, but could not control myself. I had never, so far as I can tell, been absorbed completely into the character of a headmaster, a figure of authority, of scholarship, of probity. But I was an historian, a hagiographer, a bachelor of unstained character, a winner of the Victoria Cross, the author of several admired books, a man whose course of life was set, and the bounds of whose success were defined. Yet here I was, in Mexico City, not simply attached to, but subsumed in a magic show. The day I found myself slapping one of the showgirls on the bottom and winking when she made her ritual protest, I knew that something was terribly wrong with Dunstan Ramsay. Two things that were wrong I could easily identify. I had become a dangerously indiscreet talker, and I was in love with the beautiful Faustina. I cannot say which dismayed me the more. Almost from the earliest days of my childhood, I had been close-mouthed. I never passed on gossip if I could help it, though I had no objection to hearing it. I never betrayed a confidence, preferring the costive pleasure of being a repository of secrets. Much of my intimacy with Boy Staunton rested on the fact that he could be sure I would never repeat anything I was told in confidence, and extremely little that was not so regarded.
My pleasure depended on what I knew, not on what I could tell. Yet here I was, chattering like a magpie, telling things that had never before passed my lips, and to Liesel, who did not look to me like a respecter of confidences. We talked in the afternoons, while she was working on the properties and machinery of the illusions in the tiny theater workshop under the stage. I soon found out why Liesel dominated the company. First, she was the backer, and the finance of the whole thing rested either on her money or money she had guaranteed. She was a Swiss, and the company buzz was that she came of a family that owned one of the big watch firms. Second, she was a brilliant mechanic. Her huge hands did wonders with involved springs, releases, and displacements, escapements and levers, however tiny they might be. She was a good artificer, too. She made the brazen head out of some light plastic so that it was an arresting object. Nothing in Isengrim's show was tawdry or untouched by her exacting taste. But unlike many good craftsmen, she could see beyond what she was making to its effect when in use. Sometimes she lectured me on the beauty of mechanics. "There are about a dozen basic principles," she would say, "and if they cannot be made to do everything, they can be made to create magic, if you know what you want. Some magicians try to use what they call modern techniques, rays and radar and whatnot. But every boy understands those things. Not many people really understand clockwork, because they carry it on their wrists in full sight and never think about it." She insisted on talking to me about the autobiography of Isengrim I was preparing. I had never been used to talking to anyone about a work in progress, had indeed a superstitious feeling that such talk harmed the book by robbing it of energy that should go into the writing. But Liesel always wanted to know how it was getting on, and what line I meant to take, and what splendid lies I was concocting to turn Paul Dempster into a northern wizard. We had agreed in general terms that he was to be a child of the Baltic vastnesses, reared perhaps by gnome-like Lapps after the death of his explorer parents, who were probably Russians of high birth. Better not Russians, probably Swedes or Danes who had lived long in Finland. Russians caused too much trouble at borders, and Paul still kept his Canadian passport. Or should his parents perish in the Canadian vastnesses? Anyhow, he had to be a child of the steppes, who had assumed his wolf name in tribute to the savage animals whose midnight howls had been his earliest lullaby, and to avoid revealing his distinguished family name. I had worked on the lives of several northern saints, and I had a store of this highly colored material at my fingers' ends. As we discussed these fictions, it was not surprising that Liesel should want to know the facts. In spite of her appearance and the mistrust of her I felt deep within me, she was a woman who could draw out confidences, and I heard myself rattling on about Deptford and the Dempsters and Paul's premature birth, though I did not tell all I knew of that. I even told her about the sad business in the pit and what came of it, and how Paul ran away. To my dismay, I found that I had told her about Willie, about Sergener, and even about the little Madonna. I lay awake the whole night after this last piece of blethering, and got her alone as soon as I could the next day, and begged her not to tell anyone. "No, Ramsay, I won't promise anything of the sort," said she. "You are too old a man to believe in secrets. There is really no such thing as a secret. Everybody likes to tell, and everybody does tell. Oh, there are men like priests and lawyers and doctors who are supposed not to tell what they know, but they do. Usually they do. If they don't, they grow very queer indeed. They pay a high price for their secrecy. You have paid such a price, and you look like a man full of secrets, grim-mouthed and buttoned up and hard-eyed and cruel, because you are cruel to yourself. It has done you good to tell what you know. You look much more human already. A little shaky this morning, because you are so unused to being without the pressure of all your secrets. But you will feel better quite soon." I renewed my appeal again that afternoon, but she would give no promise, and I don't think I would have believed her if she had done so. I was irrationally obsessed with an ideal of secrecy that I had carried for 50 years, only to betray it now. If a temperamental secret keeper like you cannot hold in what he knows about Isengrim, how can you expect it of anyone you despise as you despise me? She said. Oh, yes, you do despise me. You despise almost everybody except Paul's mother. No wonder she seems like a saint to you. You have made her carry the affection you should have spread among 50 people. Do not look at me with that tragic face. You should thank me. At 50 years old, you should be glad to know something of yourself. That horrid village and your hateful Scots family made you a moral monster. Well, it is not too late for you to enjoy a few years of almost normal humanity. Do not try to work on me by making sad faces, Ramsay. You are a dear fellow, but a fool. Now, tell me how you are going to get the infant Magnus Isengrim out of that dreadful Canada and into a country where big spiritual adventures are possible. If the breakdown of character that made me a chatterbox was hard to bear, it was a triviality beside the tortures of my love for the beautiful Faustina. It was a disease, and I knew it was a disease. I could see plainly everything that made her an impossible person for me to love. She was at least 30 years younger than I, to begin, and she had nothing that I would have recognized as a brain in her head. She was a monster of vanity, venomously jealous of the other girls in the show, and sulky whenever she was not being admired. She rebelled against the company rule that she might not accept invitations from men who had seen her on the stage, but she delighted in having them surge forward when she left the stage door to press flowers, sweets, and gifts of all kinds on her as she stepped into a hired limousine with Isengrim. There was one wild-eyed student boy who thrust a poem into her hand, which, as it was writing, I suppose she took for a bill and handed back to him. My heart bled for the poor simpleton. She was an animal. But I loved her. I hung about the theater to see her come and go. I lurked in the wings, to which I had been given the entree, for large screens were set up to protect the illusions from stagehands who were not members of the company, to watch her very rapid changes from Gretchen to Venus and back again, because there was an instant when, in spite of the skilled work of 2 dressers, she was almost naked. She knew it, and some nights she threw me a smile of complicity, and on others she looked offended. She could not resist admiration from anyone, and although I was something of a mystery to most of the company, she knew that I had a voice that was listened to in high places. There were whole nights when I lay awake from 1 o'clock till morning, calling up her image before my imagination. On such nights I would suffer, again and again, the worst horror of the lover. I would find myself unable to summon up the adored one's face, and I write it, hardly expecting to be believed except by someone who has suffered this abjection of adoration. I would shake at the blasphemy of having thus mislaid her likeness. I plagued myself with fruitless questions. Would the promise of a life's servitude be enough to make her stoop to me? And then, for common sense never wholly left me, I would think of the beautiful Faustina talking to curious, gaping boys at Colburn College, or meeting the other master's wives at one of their stupefying tea parties, and something like a laugh would shake me. For I was so bound to my life in Canada, you see, that I always thought of Faustina in terms of marriage and the continuance of my work. My work. As if she could have understood what education was, or why anyone would give a life to it. When I wrestled with the problem of how it could be explained to her, I was further shaken, because for the first time in my life, I began to wonder if education could be quite the splendid vocation I had, as a professional, come to think it. How could I lay my accomplishments at her beautiful feet when she was incapable of knowing what they were? Somebody, I suppose it was Liesel, told her I knew a lot about saints, and this made a kind of sense to her. One happy day, meeting me in the corridor of the theater after I had been watching her transformations in the vision of Dr. Faustus, she said, "Good evening, St. Ramsay."
"St. Dunstan," said I.
"I do not know St. Dunstan. Was he a bad old saint who peeps, eh? Oh, shame on you, St. Dunstan."
She made a very lewd motion with her hips and darted into the dressing room she shared with Isengrim.
I was in a melting ecstasy of delight and despair. She had spoken to me.
She knew I watched her and probably guessed that I loved her and longed for her. That bump or grind or whatever they called it made it very clear that— Yes, but to call me St. Dunstan? What about that? And bad old saint. She thought me old. So I was. I was 50, and in the chronology of a Peruvian girl who was probably more than half Indian, that was very old. But she had spoken, and she had shown awareness of my passion for her, and I muddled on and on most of that night, attributing subtleties to Faustina that were certainly absurd, but that I could not fight down. Officially, she was Isengrim's mistress, but they were always quarreling, for he was exquisitely neat, and she made a devastation of their dressing room. Further, it was clear enough to me that his compelling love affair was with himself. His mind was always on his public personality and on the illusions over which he fussed psychologically quite as much as Liesel did mechanically. I had seen a good deal of egotism in my life, and I knew that it starved love for anyone else and sometimes burned it out completely. Had it not been so with Boy and Leola? Still, Isengrim and the beautiful Faustina shared quarters at the hotel. I knew it because I had left my own place and moved into the even more Spanish establishment that housed the superior members of the company. They shared a room, but did it mean anything? I found out the day after she called me St. Dunstan. I was in the theater about 5 o'clock in the afternoon and chanced to go down the corridor on which the star's dressing room lay. The door was open, and I saw Faustina, naked. She was always changing her clothes. In the arms of Liesel, who held her close and kissed her passionately. She had her left arm around Faustina, and her right hand was concealed from me, but the movement of Faustina's hips and her dreamy murmurs made it clear, even to my unaccustomed eyes, what their embrace was. I have never known such a collapse of the spirit, even in the worst of the war. And this time there was no little Madonna to offer me courage or ease me into oblivion.
5. Well, dear Ramsay, you are looking a little pale.
It was Liesel who spoke. I had answered a tap on my door at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and there she stood in pajamas and dressing gown, smiling her ugly smile. What do you want?
To talk. I love to talk with you.
And you are a man who needs talk. Neither of us is sleeping, therefore we shall talk. In she came, and as the little room offered only one uncompromising, straight-backed chair, she sat down on the bed.
Come and sit by me. If I were an English lady or somebody's mother, I suppose I should begin by saying, "Now what is the matter?" But that is just rhetoric.
The matter is that you saw me and Faustina this afternoon. Oh, yes, I saw you in the looking-glass.
So?
I said nothing.
You are just like a little boy, Ramsay.
Oh, no, I am forgetting that only silly men like to be told they are like little boys.
Very well. You are like a man of 50 whose bottled-up feelings have burst their bottle and splashed glass and acid everywhere. That is why I called you a little boy, for which I apologize. But you have no art of dealing with such a situation as a man of 50, so you are thrown back to being like a little boy.
Well, I am sorry for you.
Not very much, but some.
Don't patronize me, Liesel.
That is an English word I have never really understood.
Don't bully me, then. Don't know best. Don't be the sophisticated European, the magic show gypsy, the wonderfully intuitive woman belittling the feelings of a poor brute who doesn't know any better than to think in terms of decency and honor, and not taking advantage of people who may not know what they're doing.
You mean Faustina?
Ramsay, she is a wonderful creature, but in a way you don't begin to grasp.
She isn't one of your North American girls, half B.A. and half B.F. and half good decent spud.
That's three halves, but never mind.
She is of the earth, and her body is her shop and her temple, and whatever her body tells her is all of the law and the prophets.
You can't understand such a person, but there are more of them in the world than of the women who are tangled up in honor and decency and the other very masculine things you admire so much.
Faustina is a great work of the Creator. She has nothing of what you call brains. She doesn't need them for her destiny. Don't glare at me because I speak of her destiny. It is to be glorious for a few years, not to outlive some dull husband and leave on his money till she is 80, going to lectures and comparing the attractions of winter tours that offer the romance of the Caribbean. You talk as though you thought you were God. I beg your pardon. That is your privilege, you pseudo-cynical old pussycat, watching life from the sidelines and knowing where all the players go wrong. Life is a spectator sport to you. Now you have taken a tumble and found yourself in the middle of the fight, and you are whimpering because it is rough. Liesel, I am too tired and sick to wrangle. But let me tell you this, and you may laugh as loud and as long as you please, and babble it to everybody you know, because that is your professed way of dealing with confidences. I loved Faustina. But you don't love her now because of what you saw this afternoon. Oh, knight! Oh, saint! You loved her, but you never gave her a gift, or paid her a compliment, or asked her to eat with you, or tried to give her what Faustina understands as love. A sweet physical convulsion shared with an interesting partner. Liesel, I am 50, and I have a wooden leg and only part of one arm. Is that interesting for Faustina? Yes, anything is for Faustina. You don't know her, but far worse, you don't know yourself. You are not so very bad, Ramsay. Thank you. Ooh, what dignity! Is that a way to accept a compliment from a lady? I tell him he is not so very bad, and he ruffles up like an old maid and makes a sour face. I must do better. You are a fascinating old fellow. How's that? If you have said what you came to say, I should like to go to bed now. Yes, I see you have taken off your wooden leg and stood it in the corner. Well, I should like to go to bed now, too. Shall we go to bed together? I looked at her with astonishment. She seemed to mean it. Well, do not look as if it were out of the question. You are 50 and not all there. I am as grotesque a woman as you are likely to meet. Wouldn't it have an unusual savor? I rose and began to hop to the door. Over the years, I have become a good hopper. But Liesel caught me by the tail of my pajama coat and pulled me back on the bed. Oh, you wanted to be like Venus and Adonis. I am to drag you into my arms and crush out your boyish modesty. Good. She was much stronger than I would have supposed, and she had no silly notions about fighting fair. I was dragged back to the bed, hopping, and pulled into her arms. I can only describe her body as rubbery, so supple yet muscular was it. Her huge, laughing face with its terrible jaw was close to my own, and her monkey-like mouth was thrust out for a kiss. I had not fought for years, not since my war, in fact. But I had to fight now for, well, for what? In my genteel encounters with Agnes Day and Gloria Mundy and Libby Doe, now so far in the past, I had always been the aggressor, insofar as there was any aggression in those slack-twisted amours. I certainly was not going to be ravished by a Swiss gargoyle. I gave a mighty heave and got a handful of her pajama coat and a good grip on her hair and threw her on the floor. She landed with a crash that almost brought down plaster. Up she bounced like a ball, and with a grab she caught up my wooden leg and hit me such a crack over my single shin that I roared and cursed. But when next she brought it down, I had never considered it as a weapon, and it was terrible with springs and rivets. I had a pillow ready and wrenched it from her. By this time, somebody downstairs was pounding on his ceiling and protesting in Spanish, but I was not to be quieted. I hopped towards Liesel, waggling the leg with such angry menace that she made the mistake of retreating, and I had her in a corner. I dropped the leg and punched her with a ferocity that I should be ashamed to recall. Still, as she was punching back and had enormous fists, it was a fair enough fight. But she began to be afraid, for I had a good Highland temper, and it was higher than I have ever known. Tears of pain or fright were running from her deep-set eyes, and blood was dribbling from a cut lip. After a few more smart cuffs, keeping my legless side propped against the wall, I began to edge her towards the door.
She grasped the handle behind her, but as she turned it, I got a good hold on the bedhead with one hand and seized her nose between the fingers of the other, and gave it such a twist that I thought I heard something crack. She shrieked, managed to tug the door open, and thundered down the passage. I sank back on the bed. I was worn out. I was puffing, but I felt fine. I felt better than I had done for 3 weeks. I thought of Faustina. Good old Faustina. Had I trounced Liesel to avenge her? No, I decided that I had not. A great cloud seemed to have lifted from my spirit, and though it was too soon to be sure, I thought that perhaps my reason, such as it was, had begun to climb back into the saddle, and that with care I might soon be myself again. I had eaten no dinner in my misery, and I discovered I was hungry. I had no food, but I had a flask of whiskey in my briefcase. I found it and lay back on the bed, taking a generous swig. The room was a battlefield, but I would tidy it in the morning. Liesel's dressing gown and a few rags from her pajamas lay about, and I left them where they were. Honorable trophies. There came a tap on the door. "What is it?" I called out in English.
"Signor," hissed a protesting voice. "This honeymoon. Oh, very well. Very well for you, signor. But please to remember there are those below who are not so young. If you please, signor."
I apologized elaborately in Spanish, and the owner of the voice shuffled back down the passage. Honeymoon? How strangely people interpret sound. In a few minutes there was another tap, even gentler. I called out, "Who is it?" in Spanish this time. The voice was Liesel's voice.
"You will be so kind as to allow me to recover my key," it said thickly and very formally.
I opened the door, and there she stood, barefooted and holding what was left of her pajama coat over her bosom. "Of course, señora," said I, bowing as gracefully as a one-legged man can do, and gesturing to her to come in. Why I closed the door after her, I do not know. We glared at each other.
"You are much stronger than you look," said she.
"So are you," said I. Then I smiled a little. A victor's smile, I suppose. The kind of smile I smile at boys whom I have frightened out of their wits. She picked up the dressing gown, taking care not to turn her back on me. "May I offer you a drink?" said I, holding out the flask. She took it and raised it to her lips, but the whiskey stung a cut in her mouth, and she winced sharply. That took all the lingering spite out of me. "Sit down," I said, "and I'll put something on those bruises." She sat down on the bed, and, not to make a long tale of it, I washed her cuts and put a cold water compress on her nose, which had swollen astonishingly, and in about 5 minutes we were sitting up in the bed with the pillows behind us, taking turn and turn about at the flask. "How do you feel now?" said I.
"Much better. And you? How is your shin?"
"I feel better than I have felt in a very long time."
"Good. That is what I came to make you feel."
"Indeed. I thought you came to seduce me. That seems to be your hobby. Anybody and anything. Do you often get beaten up?"
"What a fool you are.
It was only a way of trying to tell you something. Not that you love me, I hope. I have believed some pretty strange things in my time, but that would test me pretty severely."
"No. I wanted to tell you that you are human, like other people."
"Have I denied it?"
"Listen, Ramsay. For the past 3 weeks you have been telling me the story of your life, with great emotional detail, and certainly it sounds as if you did not think you were human. You make yourself responsible for other people's troubles. It is your hobby. You take on the care of a poor madwoman you knew as a boy. You put up with subtle insult and being taken for granted by a boyhood friend, this big sugar man who is such a power in your part of the world. You are a friend to this woman, Leola, what a name, who gave you your congé when she wanted to marry Mr. Sugar. And you are secret and stiff-rumped about it all, and never admit it is damned good of you. That is not very human. You are a decent chap to everybody, except one special somebody, and that is Dunstan Ramsay. How can you be really good to anybody if you are not good to yourself?"
I wasn't brought up to blow a trumpet if I happened to do something for somebody.
Upbringing, so? Calvinism?
I am a Swiss, Ramsay, and I know Calvinism as well as you do. It is a cool way of life, even if you forget the religion and call it ethics or decent behavior or something else that pushes God out of it. But even Calvinism can be endured, if you will make some compromise with yourself. But you, there is a whole great piece of your life that is unlived, denied, set aside. That is why at 50 you can't bear it any longer and fly all to pieces and pour out your heart to the first really intelligent woman you have met. Me, that's to say. And get into a schoolboy yearning for a girl who is as far from you as if she lived on the moon. This is the revenge of the unlived life, Ramsay. Suddenly, it makes a fool of you. You should take a look at this side of your life you have not lived. Now don't wriggle and snuffle and try to protest. I don't mean you should have secret drunken weeks and a widow in a lacy flat who expects you every Thursday, like some suburban ruffian. You are a lot more than that. But every man has a devil, and a man of unusual quality like yourself, Ramsay, has an unusual devil. You must get to know your personal devil. You must even get to know his father, the old devil. Oh, this Christianity. Even when people swear they don't believe in it, the 1500 years of Christianity that has made our world is in their bones, and they want to show they can be Christians without Christ. Those are the worst. They have the cruelty of doctrine without the poetic grace of myth. Why don't you shake hands with your devil, Ramsay, and change this foolish life of yours? Why don't you, just for once, do something inexplicable, irrational, at the devil's bidding, and just for the hell of it? You would be a different man. What I am saying is not for everybody, of course, only for the twice-born. One always knows the twice-born. They often go so far as to take new names. Did you not say that English girl renamed you? And who was Magnus Isengrim? And me? Do you know what my name really means, Liselotte Witzliputzli? It sounds so funny, but one day you will stumble on its real meaning. Here you are, twice born, and nearer your death than your birth, and you have still to make a real life. Who are you? Where do you fit into poetry and myth? Do you know who I think you are, Ramsay? I think you are fifth business. You don't know what that is? Well, in opera, in a permanent company of the kind we keep up in Europe, you must have a prima donna, always a soprano, always the heroine, often a fool, and a tenor who always plays the lover to her. And then you must have a contralto, who is a rival to the soprano, or a sorceress, or something, and a basso, who is the villain, or the rival, or whatever threatens the tenor. So far, so good. But you cannot make a plot work without another man, and he is usually a baritone, and he is called in the profession fifth business, because he is the odd man out, the person who has no opposite of the other sex. And you must have a fifth business, because he is the one who knows the secret of the hero's birth, or comes to the assistance of the heroine when she thinks all is lost, or keeps the hermitess in her cell, or may even be the cause of somebody's death, if that is part of the plot. The prima donna and the tenor, the contralto and the basso, get all the best music and do all the spectacular things, but you cannot manage the plot without fifth business. It is not spectacular, but it is a good line of work, I can tell you, and those who play it sometimes have a career that outlasts the golden voices. Are you fifth business? You had better find out. This is not a verbatim report, Headmaster. I said a good deal myself, and I have tidied Liesel's English and boiled down what she said. But we talked till a clock somewhere struck 4, and then fell happily asleep, but not without having achieved the purpose for which Liesel had first of all invaded my room. With such a gargoyle, and yet never have I known such deep delight or such an aftermath of healing tenderness. Next morning, tied to my door handle, was a bunch of flowers and a message in elegant Spanish. Forgive my ill manners of last night. Love conquers all, and youth must be served. May you know 100 years of happy nights. Your neighbor in the chamber below.
Chapter 6 The Soiree of Illusions 1
The autobiography of Magnus Isengrim was a great pleasure to write, for I was under no obligation to be historically correct or to weigh evidence. I let myself go and invented just such a book about a magician as I would have wanted to read if I had been a member of his public. It was full of romance and marvels, with a quiet but sufficient undertone of eroticism and sadism, and it sold like hotcakes. Liesel and I had imagined it would sell reasonably well in the lobbies of theaters where the show was appearing, but it did well in bookstores, and in a paperback edition that soon followed, it was a steady seller in cigar stores and other places where they offer lively, sensational reading. People who had never done an hour's concentrated work in their lives loved to read how the young Magnus would rehearse his card and coin sleights for 14 hours at a stretch until his body was drenched in nervous sweat and he could take no nourishment but a huge glass of cream laced with brandy. People whose own love lives were pitched entirely in the key of C were enchanted to know that at the time when he was devoting himself entirely to the study of hypnotism, his every glance was so supercharged that lovely women forced themselves upon him, poor moths driven to immolate themselves in his flame. I wrote about the hidden workshop in a Tyrolean castle where he devised his illusions, and dropped hints that girls had sometimes been terribly injured in some device that was not quite perfect. Of course, Isengrim paid to have them put right again. I made him something of a monster, but not too much of a monster. I also made his age a matter of conjecture. It was a lively piece of work, and all I regretted was that I had not made a harder bargain for my share of the profit. As it was, it brought me a pleasant annual addition to my income, and does so still. I wrote it in a quiet place in the Adirondacks, to which I went a few days after my nocturnal encounter with Liesel. Isengrim's engagement at the Teatro Chueca was drawing to an end, and the show was to visit a few Central American cities before going to Europe, where a long tour was hoped for. I gave the beautiful Faustina a handsome and fairly expensive necklace as a parting present, and she gave me a kiss, which she and I both regarded as a fair exchange. I gave Isengrim a really expensive set of studs and links for his evening dress, which staggered him, for he was a miser and could not conceive of anybody giving anything away. But I had talked earnestly with him and wrung from him a promise to contribute to the maintenance of Mrs. Dempster. He did not want to do it, swore that he owed her nothing and had indeed been driven from home by her bad reputation. I pointed out to him, however, that if this had not been the case, he would not have become the great Isengrim, but would probably be a Baptist parson in rural Canada. This was false argument, and hurt his vanity, but it helped me gain my point. Liesel helped, too. She insisted that Isengrim sign a banker's order for a sum to be paid to me monthly. She knew that if he had to send me checks, he would forget very soon. The studs and links were something to soothe his wounded avarice. I gave nothing to Liesel. By this time she and I were strong friends and took from each other something that could find no requital in presents. That money from Isengrim was not entirely necessary, but I was glad to get it. Within a month of the end of the war, I had been able to transfer Mrs. Dempster from the public wards of that hateful city asylum to a much better hospital near a small town, where she could have the status of a private patient, enjoying company if she wanted it, and gaining the advantages of better air and extensive grounds. I was able to work this through a friend who had some influence. The asylum doctors agreed that she would be better in such a place, and that she was unfit for liberty even if there had been anywhere for her to go. It meant a substantial monthly cost, and though my fortunes had increased to the point where I could afford it, my personal expenditures had to be curtailed, and I was wondering how often in future I would be able to travel in Europe. I would have thought myself false to her and to the memory of Bertha Shanklin if I had not made this change in her circumstances. But it meant a pinch, considering that I was trying to build up a fund for my retirement as well. My position was a common one. I wanted to do the right thing, but could not help regretting the damnable expense.
So, as I say, I was glad to get a regular sum from Isengrim, which amounted to about a third of what was needed, and my sense of relief led me into a stupid error of judgment. When first I visited Mrs. Dempster after returning from my 6 months' absence, I told her I had found Paul. Her condition at this time was much improved, and the forlorn and bemused look she had worn for so many years had given place to something that was almost like the sweet and sometimes humorously perceptive expression I remembered from the days when she lived at the end of a rope in Deptford. Her hair was white, but her face was not lined, and her figure was slight. I was very pleased by the improvement, but she was still in a condition to which the psychiatrists gave a variety of scientific names, but which had been called simple in Deptford. She could look after herself, talked helpfully and amusingly to other patients, and was of use in taking some of the people who were more confused than herself for walks. But she had no ordered notion of the world about her, and in particular she had no sense of time. Amasa Dempster she sometimes recalled as if he were somebody in a book she had once read inattentively. She knew me as the only constant factor in her life, but I came and went, and now, if I were absent for 6 months, it was not greatly different in her mind from the space between my weekly visits. The compulsion to visit her regularly was all my own, and sprang from a sense of duty rather than from any feeling that she missed me. Paul, however, held a very different place in her confused world, as I soon discovered. Paul, to her, was still a child, a lost boy, lost a distance of time ago that was both great and small, and to be recovered just as he had run away. Not that she really thought he had run away. Surely he had been enticed by evil people who knew what a great treasure he was. They had stolen him to be cruel, to rob a mother of her child and a child of his mother. Of such malignity she could form no clear picture, but sometimes she spoke of gypsies. Gypsies have carried the burden of the irrational dreads of stay-at-homes for many hundreds of years. I had written a passage in my life of Isengrim in which he spent some of his youth among gypsies, and as I listened to Mrs. Dempster now, I was ashamed of it. If I knew where Paul was, why had I not brought him? What had I done to recover him? Had he been ill-used? How could I tell her that I had news of Paul if I havered and temporized and would neither bring her child to her or take her to him? In vain I told her that Paul was now over 40, that he traveled much, that he had a demanding career in which he was not his own master, that he would surely visit Canada at some time, not now very far in the future. I said that he sent his love, which was a lie, for he had never said anything of the kind, and that he wanted to provide her with comfort and security. She was so excited and so unlike herself that I was shaken and even said that Paul was maintaining her in the hospital, which God knows was untrue, and proved to be another mistake. To say that a child was keeping her in a hospital was the most ridiculous thing she had ever heard. So that was it. The hospital was an elaborately disguised prison where she was held to keep her from her son. She knew well enough who was her jailer. I was the man. Dunstan Ramsay, who pretended to be a friend, was a snake in the grass, an enemy, an undoubted agent of those dark forces who had torn Paul from her. She rushed at me and tried to scratch my eyes. I was at a great disadvantage, for I was alarmed and unnerved by the storm I had caused, and also my reverence for Mrs. Dempster was so great that I could not bear to be rough with her. Fortunately, though it scared the wits out of me at the moment, she began to scream, and a nurse came on the run, and between us we soon had her powerless. But what followed was a half-hour of confusion, during which I explained to a doctor what the trouble was, and Mrs. Dempster was put to bed under what they called light restraint, straps, with an injection of something to quiet her. When I called the hospital the next day, the report was a bad one. It grew worse during the week, and in time I had to face the fact that I seemed to have turned Mrs. Dempster from a woman who was simple and nothing worse into a woman who knew there was a plot to deprive her of her little son, and that I was its agent. She was under restraint now, and it was inadvisable that I should visit her. But I did go once, driven by guilt, and though I did not see her, her window was pointed out to me, and it was in the wing where the windows are barred. 2. Thus I lost, for a time, one of the fixed stars in my universe,
and as I had brought about this great change in Mrs. Dempster's condition by my own stupidity, I felt much depressed by it. But I suffered another loss, or at least a marked change, when Boyce Staunton married for the second time, and I did not meet with the approval of his wife. During the war, Boy acquired a taste for what he believed to be politics. He had been elected in easy circumstances, for he was a conservative, and in their plan for a coalition cabinet, the liberals had not nominated anybody to oppose him. But in the years when he had great power, he forgot that he had been elected by acclamation, and came somehow to think of himself as a politician, no, a statesman, with a formidable following among the voters. He had all the delusions of the political amateur, and after the war was over, he insisted that he detected an undertone, which grew in some parts of the country to a positive clamor, that he should become leader of the Conservative Party as fast as possible, and deliver the people of Canada from their ignominious thraldom to the Liberals. He had another delusion of the political novice. He was going to apply sound business principles to government, and thereby give it a fine new gloss. So he attempted to become Conservative leader, but as he was a newcomer, he had no chance of doing so. It seemed to me that everything about Boy was wrong for politics. He was very rich, and could not understand that very rich men are not loved by the majority. He was handsome, and handsome men are not popular in politics, even with women. He had no political friends, and could not understand why they were necessary. In spite of his handicaps, he was elected once, when a by-election opened a parliamentary seat traditionally conservative. The voters remembered his services during the war, and gave him a majority of less than 1,000. But he made a number of silly speeches in the Commons, which caused a few newspapers to say that he was an authoritarian. Then he abused the newspapers in the Commons, and they made him smart for it. Boy had no idea what a mark he presented to jealous or temperamentally derisive people. However, he gained some supporters, and among them was Denise Hornick. She was a power in the world of women. She had been in the Wrens during the war, and had risen from the ranks to be a lieutenant commander, and a very capable one. After the war, she had established a small travel agency, and made it a big one. She liked what Boy stood for in politics, and after a few meetings, she liked Boy personally. I must not read into her actions motives of which I can have no knowledge, but it looked to me as if she decided that she would marry him and make him think it was his own idea. Boy had always been fond of the sexual pleasure women could give him, but I doubt if he ever knew much about women as people, and certainly a determined and clever woman like Denise was something outside his experience. He was drawn to her at first because she was prominent in two or three groups that worked for a larger feminine influence in public affairs, and thus could influence a large number of votes. Soon he discovered that she understood his political ideas better than anybody else, and he paid her a compliment typical of himself by assuring everybody that she had a masculine mind. The by-election gave him a couple of years in Parliament before a general election came along to test his real strength. By that time, any public gratitude for what he had done as a war organizer had been forgotten. The Conservative Party found him an embarrassment because he was apt to criticize the party leader in public. The Liberals naturally wanted to defeat him, and the newspapers were out to get him. It was a dreadful campaign on his part, for he lost his head, bullied his electors when he should have wooed them, and got into a wrangle with a large newspaper, which he threatened to sue for libel. He was defeated on election day so decisively that it was obviously a personal rather than a political rejection. He made an unforgettable appearance on television as soon as his defeat had been conceded. "How do you feel about the result in your riding, Mr. Staunton?" asked the interviewer, expecting something crisp, but not what he got. "I feel exactly like Lazarus," said Boy, "licked by the dogs." The whole country laughed about it, and the newspaper he thought had libeled him read him a pompous little editorial lecture about the nature of democracy. But there were those who were faithful, and Denise was at the top of that list. In the course of time, the press tired of baiting him, and there were a few editorials regretting that so much obvious ability was not being used for the public good. But it was no use. Boy was through with politics and turned back to sugar, and everything sugar could be made to do, with new resolve. Denise had other ambitions for him, and she was a wilier politician than he.
She thought he would make a very fine lieutenant governor of the province of Ontario, and set to work to see that he got it. Necessarily, it was a long campaign. The lieutenant governorship was in the gift of the crown, which meant, in effect, that the holder of the office was named by the Dominion cabinet. A lieutenant governor had only recently been appointed, and as he was in excellent health, it would be 5 years, and possibly longer, before Boy would have a chance. On his side was one strong point. It cost a lot of money to be lieutenant governor, for the duties were ample and the stipend was not, so candidates for the post were never many. But a Liberal government at Ottawa would not be likely to appoint a former Conservative parliamentarian to such a post, so there would have to be a change of government if Boy were to have a chance. It was a plan full of risks and contingencies, and if it were to succeed, it would be through careful diplomacy and a substantial amount of luck. It was characteristic of Denise that she decided to get busy with the diplomacy at once, so as to be ready for the luck if it came. Boy thought the idea a brilliant one. He had never lost his taste for matters connected with the crown. He had no doubt of his ability to fill a ceremonial post with distinction, and even to give it larger dimensions. He had everything the office needed, with one exception. A lieutenant governor must have a wife. It was here that Denise's masculinity of mind showed itself with the greatest clarity. Boy told me exactly what she said when first the matter came up between them. "I can't help you there," she said. "You're on your own so far as that goes." And then she went straight on to discuss the rationale of the lieutenant governor's office, those privileges which made it a safeguard against any tyrannous act on the part of a packed legislature. It was by no means a purely ceremonial post, she said, but an agency through which the Crown exercised its traditional function of safeguarding the Constitution against politicians who forgot that they had been elected to serve the people and not to exploit them. She had informed herself thoroughly on the subject and knew the powers and limitations of a lieutenant governor as well as any constitutional lawyer. Boy had been aware for some time that Denise was attractive. Now he saw that she was lovable. Her intelligent, cool, unswerving devotion to his interests had impressed him from very early in their association, but her masculinity of mind had kept him at a distance. Now he became aware that this poor girl had sacrificed so much of her feminine self in order to gain success in the business world and to advance the cause of women who lacked her clarity of vision and common sense, that she had almost forgotten that she was a woman, and a damned attractive one. When love strikes the successful middle-aged, they bring a weight of personality and a resolution to it that makes the romances of the young seem timid and bungling. They are not troubled by doubt. They know what they want, and they go after it. Boy decided he wanted Denise. Denise was not so easily achieved. Boy told me all about his wooing. Matters between us were still as they had been for 30 years, and the only difference was that Liesel had taught me that his confidences were not wrung from him against his will, but gushed like oil from a well, and that I, as fifth business, was his logical confidant. Denise at first refused to hear his professions of love. Her reasons were two. Her business was her creation and demanded the best of her, and as a friend of Boy's, she did not want him to imperil a fine career by an attachment that contained dangers. "What dangers?" he demanded. Well, she confided, rather unwillingly, there had been Hornick. She had married him very early in the war, when she was 20. It had been a brief and disagreeable marriage, which she had terminated by a divorce. Could a representative of the Crown have a wife who was a divorcee? Boy swept this aside. Queen Victoria was dead. Even King George was dead. Everybody recognized the necessity and humanity of divorce nowadays, and Denise's splendid campaigns for liberalizing the divorce laws had put her in a special category. But Denise had more to confess. There had been other men. She was a woman of normal physical needs, she admitted it without shame, and there had been one or two other attachments. "Poor kid," said Boy, "she was still a victim of the ridiculous double standard." He told Denise about his dreadful mistake with Leola, and how it had driven him, positively driven him, to seek outside marriage qualities of understanding and physical response that were not to be found at home. She understood this perfectly, but he had to argue for a long time to get her to see that the same common-sense view applied to herself. It was in such things as this, Boy told me with a fatuous smile, that Denise's masculinity of mind failed her. He had to be pretty stern with her to make her understand that what was sauce for the gander was certainly sauce for the goose. Indeed, he called her little goose for a few days, but gave it up because of the ribald connotation of the word. Then, he smiled sadly when he explained the absurdity of this to me, there was her final objection, which was that people might imagine she married him for his money and the position he could give her. She was a small-town girl, and though she had gained a certain degree of know-how through her experience of life, I am not positive, but I think she even went so far as to say that she was a graduate of the School of Hard Knocks. She doubted if she was up to being Mrs. Boy Staunton, and just possibly the Lieutenant Governor's lady. Suppose, just suppose for a moment, that she were called upon to entertain royalty. No, Denise Hornick knew her strengths and her weaknesses, and she loved Boy far too well ever to expose him to embarrassment on her account. Yes, she loved him. Had always done so. Understood the fiery and impatient spirit that could not endure the popularity contest side of modern politics. Thought of him, didn't want to seem highbrow, but she did do a little serious reading, as a Canadian Coriolanus. You common cry of curs, whose breath I hate. She could imagine him saying it to those sons of bitches who had turned on him at the last election. Yearned towards him in her heart as a really great man who was too proud to shake hands and kiss babies to persuade a lot of riffraff to let him do what he was so obviously born to do. Thus, the masculinity of mind that had made Denise Hornick a success in her world was swept aside, and the tender, loving woman beneath was discovered and awakened by Boy.